Natalia Grace Barnett is one of the most bizarre and interesting cases we have ever covered on this show. Her adoptive parents, Michael and Christine Barnett, were accused of criminal abandonment when they set her up in an apartment. Why? Because nobody knew how old Natalia really was. She literally could have been anywhere between the ages of 8 and 22, or maybe even older. Hopefully you've had enough caffeine today so your brain can follow all the crazy twists and turns in this spellbinding case.
Helen, missing, hidden, the podcast about bad things.
Welcome, welcome, welcome into Killing, Missing, Hidden, the greatest podcast in all of sports entertainment. No, wait. True crime. Bad things. Not John Cena things. Even still, I'm your host who is covered in baby oil for this match or episode or whatever we want to call it. Your old buddy Brad, former elite criminal defense trial attorney. That's why I concern myself, at least. I hope all of you in podcast land are as adorable as you always are. We've got a really fascinating but messy case this week, and I really hope it causes your head to hurt just like mine. Natalia Grace Barnett, the child, adult, girl slash woman. This case was recommended to us by listener Southern Rebel via Instagram, so thanks SR for suggesting I stare into this pit of madness and despair. You're a doll. I will go ahead and apologize up front because my dogs have delved into madness this week, or at least today. They want something, but we can't figure out what. So if you hear the screams of puppies who sound like they're being tortured, they're not. They're just being difficult. All right. Well, I don't really have anything worth babbling about, so we're just going to jump straight into this roller coaster ride and get it started. Michael and Christine Barnett were charged in September 2019 for neglect and abandoning a child after leaving their adopted daughter behind an Indiana apartment on her own while the rest of the family moved to Canada in 2012, 7 years before. The adopted child, Natalia Grace Barnett, was only 9 years old and had been adopted by the Barnetts from Ukraine in April of 2010. The couple, who had divorced in 2014, quickly turned on each other and their adopted child. Eventually, this case would go to trial, at least for Michael, who ended up being acquitted of all charges in October of 2022. The charges against Christine were dismissed in March of 2023. Okay. That's a really dense way to open up a story, I know, and there's a lot to unpack here, obviously. If you haven't heard of Natalia Grace, she is now, as she's now commonly known, this is an almost unbelievable tale, such that Investigation Discovery produced a 6-part series on this story. I mean, seriously, this sounds like it comes from a Hollywood movie more so than from the newspapers. So I'm going to try to find a foothold here from which we can really begin this story. Natalia was intended to be the daughter the Barnetts never had. They were blessed with 3 children, but they didn't feel like they were a complete family because they had all boys. They wanted a daughter to raise, and so they decided to do the more certain and more charitable thing by adopting a child. Now, they had some opportunities that kind of fell through when suddenly they were contacted by an agency known as Adoption by Shepherd Care out of Hollywood, Florida. And basically they were told that they had a chance to adopt little Natalia. Based on all the legal documentation sent by the agency from the Ukrainian orphanage, Natalia was born on September 4th, 2003. Okay, and this again is in 2009. Now, this wasn't one of those situations where the Barnetts were going to fly to Ukraine to pick up Natalia. She was already in the U.S. She had been previously adopted, and she was about to go back into the foster care system. Now, this fortunately made the adoption process much easier for the Barnetts. They wouldn't need to jump through hoops of the Ukrainian government and the U.S. government to make this happen. Now, supposedly the first family had given up on Natalia because she had tried to hurt one of their other boys. She explained this away at a later time by saying, you know, she and her adoptive brother were just wrestling, and apparently to her mom, it looked like she was trying to break the boy's arm, but they were really just playing. Now, the Barnetts were in a situation where the agency told them, look, you've only got 24 hours to decide whether or not you want Natalia, because she's going to go into the foster care system if you don't make a decision within that time frame. So they fly from Indiana down to Florida and meet this little girl, fall in love with her, and adopt her. They decide to spend the week in Florida, specifically at Disney World. And immediately, there were some red flags the Barnetts noticed. During the first bath they gave her, the couple noticed something very shocking. Natalia had full pubic hair and noticeable breasts. Within a few weeks of arriving back home, they found evidence that she was menstruating. Socially, Natalia didn't bond with children her age and didn't really have an interest in playing with toys. She liked to hang out in the company of older children and would regularly try to read books and magazines that should have been too advanced for her. During a dental exam, it was noted that Natalia had all of her adult teeth. She also failed to grow a single inch, a single centimeter, while living in the Barnett's house. And a bone test proved that Natalia was actually at least 14 when she was adopted. Obviously confused and concerned, the Barnetts tried to discuss the matter with Natalia. You know, they wanted to know her true age. They wanted to know the real story of what was going on. But this didn't go well, according to the family. It's like a switch flipped in her. And Natalia went from being childlike in her mannerisms, forced mannerisms, the Barnetts believed, to, in Michael's words, acting like a sociopath. She began stealing knives from the kitchen and hiding them under her mattress. She would ominously appear in the Barnett's marital bedroom at odd hours of the night, standing next to the couple with a knife in one hand, until one of them awoke, wherein she said, "Oh, I came here to kill you." Christine claims she caught Natalia trying to poison her coffee with bleach or some sort of cleaning agent. It varies story by story. When she was angered, Natalia would scream that she was going to murder all the Barnett sons and bury their bodies under the back deck. Natalia once attacked a family friend's baby. She also found it hilarious to smear feces on her brother's faces. She told the Barnetts she heard voices. She even made an effort to push Christine into an electric fence. Certainly, behavior like this can't be tolerated, regardless of a child's age. So the Barnetts arranged for Natalia to visit a local hospital in 2012. Specifically, what they called a stress center, but was really a psych ward, a long-term psych ward. During her stay, she was considered to be unusually sexually aggressive by the staff. I mean, not just for a child, just overall on the spectrum, she was unusually aggressive in her sexuality. Many of the staff members refused to believe she was a child. There's reports that she confessed to the doctors that were treating her that she was much older than her birth records indicated. In 2013, she was discharged from psychiatric care. And there's little to no information online about what their, diagnosis was or what They never publicly said what was wrong with her, though Michael claims she was diagnosed as a sociopath, but the hospital refused to keep her anymore and she had to go back to the Barnetts. Now, it's my understanding, and psychology is not my area of expertise, that you aren't, psychopath is not a term that exists in the psychiatric world anymore. It's an antiquated term. I think something like borderline personality disorder or something like that has replaced it. I don't know what I'm talking about. I could be totally wrong there, but I feel confident about, you know, she wouldn't be diagnosed as a sociopath, but that's what Michael says. So anyway, when Natalia comes back home, the Barnetts kind of nope out of the situation. They were not willing to take care of what they believed an adult who was, you know, wanting to kill them. So they rented an apartment for Natalia. They paid the rent for the entire 1 year lease period and wished her well. While she was in the hospital, you know, after hearing, having all these medical exams and then hearing the reports from the doctors in the hospital, they petitioned the probate court to amend her birth certificate to indicate her true age. Now, nobody knows what her true age was, but the judge, based on the evidence submitted, decided that she was approximately 22 years old. So that's what they did. She went from having a birth year of 2003 to 1989. So she's living in this apartment, and when her lease expired, the landlord, the company that owned these apartments, refused to let her renew her lease because she basically had been a horrible tenant. None of the neighbors liked her. A lot of them were scared of her. There were accusations that she was terrorizing children in the neighborhood and sexually harassing her neighbors. One former neighbor, Sue McCollum, was described in one newspaper report, or described Natalia in one newspaper report, as being evil and devious. So her lease expires and Natalia has nowhere to go. So she calls the police, claiming the Barnetts had simply dumped her off at this apartment. She was only a child. She didn't know what to do. So she kind of goes back into the system and soon ends up with the Mann's family, who fully buy into, believe, and support Natalia's version of events. It took police and prosecutors until 2019 to decide whether the Barnetts had committed a crime and ultimately believed they did. Either they abandoned a child or they neglected a family member who needed special assistance. Hence, two charges were brought against both of them. Prosecutors claimed they were in contact with Natalia's birth mother and confirmed her birth date truly was 2003, which, if true, would mean that Natalia was a minor and was left at the apartment as a child. The neglect charge was based upon leaving her, regardless of her age, in a living situation which was not designed to meet her needs. I haven't mentioned this yet, and I should have from the get-go. Natalia suffered from a very rare and specific form of dwarfism. She was a little person, and her condition only, like, 34,000 people in the world have it. So anyway, prosecutors also learned that the same clinic that performed the bone density scans on Natalia, which the Barnetts represented, determined she was no longer than 14 at the time of adoption, actually reached a different conclusion. In 2011, the clinic determined she was approximately 11 years old, which would have been pretty close to what her birth certificate said. The Mann's family also testified that Natalia did not menstruate while living with their family, at least initially. Michael allegedly admitted to police that when they left Natalia behind, he thought Natalia was a child, but Christine insisted she was adult and they had to get rid of her. Natalia's court-appointed guardian ad litem was of the opinion during the man's adoption proceedings that Natalia was a teenager. Now, a guardian ad litem, in case you don't know, that is an attorney appointed to represent a minor in a proceeding. It's a very unique position to hold in a case because, you know, a lawyer, if you hire a lawyer, their job is to represent your interests, to do what you want them to do. You know, they work for you, essentially. That's not true if you're a guardian ad litem. You're appointed to represent the best interests of the child or somebody who otherwise can't make decisions for themselves. And so you don't have to listen to your client as a GAL. You do what you think is best for the child or the person. Now, going back to the medical records, the Barnett's primary care physician gave the opinion that Natalia is, quote, substantially older than she claimed to be. And basically had just made a living out of lying about her age. FYI, the Manns were not able to adopt Natalia since she had already been determined to legally be an adult based off of her new birth certificate. I know, this case is going all over the place, and I'm getting confused as I even try to get through these basic facts. Now, to clarify, the Barnetts knew from the get-go that Natalia had the dysphasia that we talked about. But still, a child with this condition at such a young age, if true, I mean, the child would still grow. It's just that her maximum height would be limited. And it's also undisputed that the apartment the Barnetts rented for Natalia did not contain any accommodations she would need to live there safely. I remember specifically like the laundry room. She couldn't reach the quarter slot where you would put your clothes in to wash them. Natalia was interviewed in kind of an infamous Dr. Phil segment in 2019 after the charges initially came out. During this interview, she claimed she was treated like an animal by the Barnetts. She said she wasn't allowed to eat with the family and was basically fed from open cans like a dog or a cat. What I understood is they would open up a can of vegetables or what have you and just leave it on the table and she could eat from that, according to her story. Natalia claimed Christine was violent with her and would beat her whenever she was angry. She also insisted the Barnetts made her tell others she was 22 when she was still just a child. She claimed during the interview she was only a 16-year-old kid, not a 33-year-old scam artist, as she was being painted out to be. Interestingly, both Michael and one of the Barnett sons corroborated one of Natalia's claims that Christine would get irrationally angry and violent when she was upset. But all the boys claimed Natalia was a bad seed who would attempt to intimidate and harass them and would not afraid to use threats of violence to get her way. As of today, Natalia lives with a man's family. And today, she is unquestionably an adult, regardless of which birth certificate you look at, as she would be at least 19. All right, so that's a rough outline of the basic facts of this case. But as I said at the beginning, there is a documentary that's been put out by Investigative Discovery that really goes deep into this case. And I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow of everything they cover. If you're interested in the case, you should very much watch it. I'm leaving out a lot of things, but I'm just going to describe some of the feelings and impressions it left with me. And this was just released. It came out over a period of 3 days from May 29th through 31st. Now, it's important to note that only Michael and his oldest son participated in this documentary. It's also important to note that the bulk of the interviews from Michael and his oldest son come from two different time periods. They are interviewed once in 2019 when the charges first came to life, and then again in 2020 as Michael was headed towards trial. Christine did not participate. She gave some ugly comment along the lines of, I'm not going to help buoy a dying network or something like that. Natalia chose not to participate, but there was a whole bunch of people in their orbit that were willing to sit down and talk about it. Neighbors, friends, those sorts of folks. We even have a talking head legal expert who was involved in this case, who absolutely annoyed me to no end because she clearly had an axe to grind. She was not there to be objective. She was there to argue for one side. So what we get from this documentary is initially we learn the Barnett's life pre-Natalia. They were just this happy, perfect family when they decided that there was room for one more child. You know, Michael makes a point to show off that, you know, they owned a McMansion, he called it. He had several hundred thousand dollars in the checking account. He owned all these exotic cars. Yada, yada, yada. And so then they talk about, you know, learning about Natalia and that catch that they only have 24 hours if they're going to adopt her. And both Michael and Christine thought this was kind of a sign from above that this child needed to be adopted and she needed to be in y'all's life because she has these special needs. Michael says that week in Florida that they spent at Disney World was the last time the family was ever happy. They talk endlessly about how Natalia didn't act or look like a six-year-old girl. They actually, remember how I said that she suffers from this rare form of dwarfism? One in 34,000 people in the world have it. Well, one of those people who has it happened to live in Indiana and happened to also be 6 years old. So the Barnetts made contact with this family and kind of set up a play date. Well, when they go to the play date, it's obvious Natalia is not the same age as this other child. Just the facial structure, the height, the size, the mannerisms, it's almost laughable. And it was so obviously bad that the mother of the other child never contacted the Barnetts again. And they show a picture of this on the Discovery documentary if you want to see what I'm talking about. We also start hearing stories about how Natalia loved urinating and defecating in the car, how she would steal her brother's toys, hide them for a while, and then when they would go somewhere, she would toss them out into busy streets, either hoping to destroy them or to try to goad the child into running out into traffic. The Barnetts claim they eventually take Natalia to a therapist, then another, then another. They go to four, and the fourth one is the first one they claim really listened to them. And that therapist says, you've got a very dangerous person in your household. She cannot be left alone. Like, if she needs to go to the bathroom, you need to escort her to the bathroom. You should put a lock on the outside of her door. That level of dangerousness. And they Michael recounts all the horrible things they experienced. The oldest child, you know, he's very hesitant to go into a lot of details during his interviews, but he does admit that he was scared of her. So you remember me mentioning a little bit ago about an electric fence incident. Well, here's a story on that as told by this documentary. So the youngest boy, who is the same age as Natalia, at least on paper, loved cows. And for his birthday, they decide to take him to a farm. And it's a farm where you can pet cows and milk cows. And, you know, it would be a neat experience for a 6 or 7 year old. While they're there, they're being briefed on what to do, what not to do, and all that. And they're told that, you know, the outer perimeter fence is electrified. Be careful around it. And Michael insists that upon hearing this, Natalia just gets extremely interested in the fence, asks questions about it and all this stuff. So while they're exploring the land, Natalia gets wore out and she has to sit down. And Christine takes this as an act of, you know, passive aggressiveness, So she tells the boys, y'all go on, I'll stay with her. She's not ruining this day. Well, again, remember, she suffers from dwarfism. She's wearing braces. It's difficult for her to walk. And according to Michael, this trail they were on was a mile and a half long. So I'm not saying anybody's wrong or right here, but I can understand why somebody with Natalia's condition might want to sit down. The location she picked to stop at was within 10 feet of this electric fence. Michael claims in his 2019 interview that the boys head on, and after about 50 or 60 yards of hiking, they hear yelling and a struggle, and they see Natalia trying to pull Christine into the electric fence. The police are called, they show up, and according to the Barnetts, they refuse to believe that this little girl posed a real threat, but they did see that something was off about her, so they agreed to take her to the state mental hospital. The farm workers are eventually interviewed on this documentary about what happened, and they kind of unanimously say, you know, that the, I think they say, they use the term the caretaker, aka Christine, was the one getting emotional, that was blowing it out of proportion. They didn't see what the problem was. In addition to that, they were not near an electric fence when this occurred. Now, that's a false statement that I've just made. Technically, they were near an electric fence, but it was not turned on this day because all of the cows were on a different part of the pasture where they were hiking to. And they apparently were made aware that this fence wasn't turned on. It wasn't turned on until you got to where the cows were. And on top of that, the fence isn't strong enough to really cause any harm. You know, you wouldn't like touching it, but it's not going to send you into cardiac arrest. Michael, when he's interviewed again in 2022, tells a different story, that he was over a mile away when this happened. He didn't see what was going on. When he got to the scene, you know, he ignored the police. He ignored the ambulance that was called out. And he spoke to his wife alone. Now, regardless of what really happened, Natalia does go to the state mental health facility. And when she's admitted, she is assigned to the adult wing because the doctors believed her to be an adult. Again, she has pubic hair. She has breasts. There are allegedly are records from her dentist indicating that she has all her adult teeth, no child's teeth. And then the documentary interviews several of the workers from the hospital who all want to remain anonymous. But they kind of unanimously say, this was an adult. This was not a child. And this was a very troubled adult. And a very difficult to care for adult. She was constantly, you know, asking other patients to be her boyfriend, making sexual remarks at them. She would alter her clothes to show off her body in certain ways. And, you know, this, again, this isn't a typical mental health facility. This is a state mental health facility where there are people who are there for criminal reasons. And so the hospital's reason for releasing Natalia from their care is she is creating a dangerous situation because we have men in here who don't do well around children, who don't do well around women. And she's doing everything she can to provoke them. Michael claims a detective was the one who suggested to him that Natalia be re-aged. And he says the detective in question actually gave him a business card of an attorney who specialized in this. All right. First of all, cops don't give out attorneys' business cards. An attorney would get in trouble for asking a cop to do that. A cop would get in trouble for doing that. And if they're going to do it, they're going to do it for criminal law cases, not amending birth certificates. So that story smells to me. On top of that, according to the police file, the detective that Michael says understood what was going on, saw the danger of the situation, he sent an email to the Department of Child Services in Indiana saying that Natalia, while there were some questions, he acknowledged there were some questions, it was his opinion she was a child. Now, unfortunately, the detective passed away several years ago, so he wasn't able to be interviewed for the story. And another detective in his department, you know, was vaguely aware of the file, but and he notes that he had several conversations with the Barnetts, according to the case file notes, but he doesn't know what was said in there. But he's got a copy of that email, you know, where this officer expresses the belief that Natalia is a child. Many of Natalia's neighbors were interviewed from that apartment she lived in. And to clarify, despite what I said in the beginning, she actually stayed in two apartments, according to this documentary. What I've done, I'm doing a terrible job at just explaining everything today, but the first part of the story is my research into it. This right now, we're talking about what the documentary presents. Documentary is probably a little bit more reliable, but it has been shaped in a way to meet the editorial demands of the producers. But I'm trying to just distill it down to the facts from it. So, interviewing these neighbors, right? Most of them believe she was an adult, but acted in a very childlike way. One neighbor reported that Christine would occasionally bring Natalia groceries, but she would kind of carry the bags to Natalia's front door, not bring them inside for her, and then would sit in her car and watch her struggle to bring them inside. Natalia's immediate neighbor in this apartment complex, and when I say apartments, it's not a what I would traditionally describe as an apartment complex. It's a series of townhouses that are rented out as apartments. And so her neighbor, who is elderly, sees her struggling and offers to help and, you know, gets everything in. And Natalia can't reach the cupboards, you know, that are higher up on the wall and whatnot. So she helps her with that and everything. And they kind of sort of not became friends, I guess, but they were willing to help each other out. There is this weird video that's shown in the documentary of Michael coming to visit Natalia. And it's a very awkward video to watch, and it's clear there's a lot of hostility in Michael's intent in being there. And, you know, he's constantly accusing her of not telling the truth. And he goes into the cabinet to inspect everything and finds that Natalia has donuts. And this really pushes his button for some reason. So he grills her on these donuts. Where'd you get them? How'd you get them? Why do you have them? All this stuff. But in turn, Natalia is not the least bit truthful about it. It's obvious she's lying about where she got them, why she got them, all that. But, you know, of course, I'm sitting here watching it like, who cares? It's donuts. Why are you fighting this fight? It's just very clear from this video, in my opinion, that Michael and Natalia had a very hostile relationship. There's another video that Michael shoots and provides for this documentary where some of the neighbors get concerned about Natalia because a few of them do believe that she's a minor. And so they call the Department of Child Services, who come out and, you know, do an investigation and all that mess. Well, Michael believes that because the same caseworker came out as before when they had the whole incident with her at the farm and everything, that Natalia must have been the one contacting her. So he takes Natalia's cell phone and deletes this everything to do with this social worker. Basically saying, now you can't call for help from them. Now, then on the other side of the coin, neighbors are complaining to building management constantly because Natalia developed this habit of just walking into unlocked apartments without being asked. And, you know, one resident described it as, you know, she was sitting down watching TV and Natalia just walked in and didn't knock or anything. And she felt like Natalia was casing the joint. But typically what would happen is she would come in and she would raid their fridge and get something to eat. She did have an incident where she walked into her elderly neighbor's apartment while her grandson was visiting. The neighbor, the grandmother, had gone out to run an errand. And the grandchild was there with one of his buddies. They were playing Xbox, and apparently Natalia flirted with them, made some inappropriate remarks, and the child asked Natalia to leave. The neighbor confronted Natalia about this and basically said, you never, ever, ever talk to my grandchild again, and don't you ever think about setting foot inside my apartment again. There was a fella who complained to management because he was doing his laundry. And like any laundry rooms in an apartment complex, it's not a very big room. So as he's pulling his clothes out of the dryer, he's folding them and putting them into his laundry basket. Natalia comes in and kind of corners him in a way. And is being very sexually suggestive. And is willing to, according to his neighbor, to exchange money for sexual, or exchange sexual favors for money. And the fella just couldn't get out of there fast enough. Most troubling of all, there was multiple reports of an incident where Natalia was playing with a child in the neighborhood in kind of this field at the end of the road that these townhouses were built on. And they were, you know, sword fighting with sticks and wrestling around and all this stuff. And two neighbors witnessed Natalia unbuttoning the child's pants and pulling them down. More neighbors than that saw the interactions between Natalia and the child, but weren't close enough to see the pants being pulled down, but they knew something funky was going on. Well, it just so happened the dad of the child was a third witness who saw this going on. And he goes running out there, picks up his boy and says, don't you ever talk to my son again, and leaves. During this time, for whatever reason, Natalia calls 911 on herself and self-reports that she has been stalking some of her neighbors. She has an urge to hurt one of her neighbors, and she doesn't know if she can control it. But we get no information about what happens after that 911 call. You know, traditionally, she would be taken into custody and voluntarily committed, given some psychiatric care. We have no clue what happened here. All right, so according to this documentary, when that first lease ended, she did not, you know, call the cops and say, I don't know what to do. I'm a child that's been abandoned. It's reported that she called Michael and Christine. And so Christine says, I'm going to find her an apartment this time. And they go to Lafayette, Indiana, which is the home of Purdue University. But apparently, I didn't know this. I'm taking the representations made by the documentary. Lafayette is not a very safe town, or at least parts of it are very unsafe. And this is where Christine got Natalia an apartment in a very rough section of the town. Now, in the 2019 interview, Michael defends this decision. He says the apartment's 2 blocks to a grocery store, 2 blocks to the nearest bus stop, 2 blocks from the GED Center, where Natalia would be taking her classes. And basically, everything she could want was within walking distance. In his 2022 interview, he says Christine insisted that they take Natalia to Lafayette because it's a white trash city. She's a white trash girl. And if they put her in the right spot, she'll disappear and nobody will care about her. Now, the apartment they got is very suspect. It's on the second floor of this complex. And again, this is a girl who has difficulty walking. She's had multiple surgeries to try to straighten out the bones in her feet and legs so she can walk better. She wears braces. It is 19 steps for her to get to her apartment. And again, there's no accommodations made for her to be able to reach things like the upper cabinets, washer and dryer, all that stuff. While living there, the Barnetts did not have her utilities turned on. They took away her cell phone. And so she was virtually isolated. When Natalia complained to a neighbor about this, the neighbor had Natalia call Michael on speakerphone so the neighbor could hear. And Michael apparently did not know that the utilities had not been connected, and he made arrangements to get that taken care of. But for a period of at least a few days, maybe up to a week, she's got no electricity, no water, nothing. They do set her up with a lot of social services. So she gets $500 a month in, you know, food stamps. She gets a Social Security disability check of an undisclosed amount every month. The $500 for food goes directly to Natalia. She has basically a debit card, and it gets refilled every month. The disability check, however, goes to Michael, and he deposits it. And he claims he uses that money to pay her rent and her utilities and whatnot. And in fairness, there's no evidence brought out that he did not do this. But one day they get a call that, and it's from the GED center, that Natalia's disappeared. They haven't seen her, they don't know where she is, and they were hoping the Barnetts could help them out. Michael claims in his 2019 interview that he did everything he could to find her, and then a day or two later, he gets a call from the GED center saying, hey, she came back, we found her, she's now living with the man's family. So, according to the documentary, she had gone to the man's family when they saw the plight she was living in, and they took pity on her, and they said, honey, come with us. We'll fix you a nice meal. We'll wash your clothes for you, blah, blah, blah. And the decision was made that you can't live in the second-story apartment by yourself. Why don't you stay with us? Again, apparently at one point they tried to adopt her, but that's not discussed in the documentary. But the documentary does confirm that she began living with the bands. Michael, again, 2019 interview, says his thoughts on why the bands took her in is it was an extra $500 a month for food. And as soon as she moved in with the mans, they took her down to the Social Security office and had her disability checks sent to them instead of to Michael. So he's insinuating they took her in for the money. Now, all of this apartment stuff in Lafayette is about the time that Michael and Christine's relationship deteriorated. They were living up in Canada because their oldest son was a bit of a genius. He had won all these awards. He had done a TED Talk. He was featured in magazines. He was on 60 Minutes. He is on the autism spectrum, but like apparently all of his focus was on physics and quantum mechanics. He loved that stuff. And so this school in Canada had invited him to come study with them. This was a very elite school, private school. They were going to give him, you know, full scholarship. And essentially he was going to be there to work up to a master's degree, is how they described it. So the whole family moves to Canada to support, you know, the oldest brother. Well, after about a year, you know, all this craziness is going on with Natalia. Michael decides this is enough. He moves back to Indiana and files for divorce. And Michael and Christine go to war. And it's at this point that police have received enough calls from neighbors, from the Department of Child Services about Natalia, that they're seriously investigating whether or not a crime is taking place here. So the detectives reach out to both couples, and of course, being in the middle of a nasty divorce, they say every horrible thing they can think of about their spouse to the detectives. Shockingly to me, and I think this says a lot about Michael and his level of maturity, the divorce ended up in a settlement. And the settlement was reached when Christine offered to have sex with Michael if he would agree to give up custody of the three boys. In other words, she got custody, he got to bump uglies with her. I don't understand it. I'm just reporting what they reported. When investigators were talking to Michael, of course, the detective is taking the attitude of, hey, I'm with you. Christine's the bad guy here. I just need all the information you can give me about what happened so I can really stick it to her. When in reality, he's trying to gather information on Michael. Cops are not your friends when they're investigating, okay? So don't believe what they're telling you. Michael makes a statement that he will soon regret, saying that in 2019, when he's being investigated, at that moment in time, he believed Natalia was really around the age of 20 or 22, which, if true, would mean she was certainly a minor when they set her up in the first apartment. There's a whole mess about, you know, on the Discovery Channel program, the documentary about everything police go through and whatnot. But we're going to skip ahead to kind of the trial. Or at least the beginning of the criminal proceedings. One of the first issues that had to be dealt with was Natalia's age. And the judge immediately ruled that, you know, prosecution, you can't, you know, we're not going to relitigate how old Natalia is. That has been determined. A judge had a hearing on it and found, you know, what her age is. So you can't refer to her as a child. You can't insinuate that she was really only 8 or 9 years old or whatever. Her birthday is 1989. That is a legal fact in this case. Do not contradict it. Huge win for the defense. Really screws up the prosecution's case, but they keep trying to fight that battle. They go so far as to travel to Ukraine, work with the Ukraine police, hire Ukraine investigators to track down Natalia's birth mother. They find the woman who claims to be her mom. She tells the story that she had Natalia. After she was born, she wasn't allowed to see Natalia. The doctor came to her and said, look, Natalia's got some severe medical issues. You won't be able to take care of her. You need to put her up for adoption. And really, really pressured her into signing over her parental rights under Ukrainian law. And she says, you know, she was young at the time. She was in her early 20s. She trusted the doctor. She didn't understand what all this was. But she insists this was in 2003. They do a DNA test on this woman and confirm she is Natalia's biological mother. But the judge won't relent. He says, look, this is a criminal proceeding. What you're talking about is a civil matter that's already been litigated. I'm sorry, but she is an adult for the purposes of this criminal hearing. When they go to trial, all these witnesses are called. It lasts about a week, from what I recall, and the jury has the case for less than 2 hours. Not guilty. Michael's over the moon. Clearly, they saw through the lies. They knew that he was doing the best he could. All that stuff. The documentary interviews the foreperson of the jury, and she said, when we walked back there, I asked, just out of curiosity, how many of y'all think Michael abandoned this girl? And she said, all 11 hands went up. And including hers, it was 12. And she said the jury really thought he had broken the law, but based off of the instructions the judge gave, they couldn't find him guilty and stay within the purview of what the judge had directed them to do. So, you know, Michael thinks he's been exonerated. The jury's like, we would have hung him out to dry if we could have. And by the by, he would have faced up to 16 years in jail if he was found guilty. Once Michael's case goes south, people are really looking forward to Christine's case because it was undisputed by prosecutors, law enforcement, defense counsel, the local bar, talking heads in the area, reporters in the area. The case against Christine was so much stronger. Michael was the trial run. Christine was the one they wanted to nail. Yet in March 2023, they dismissed the charges against her. One thing I want to say about the interview in general is nobody looks good in this thing. This whole documentary, I mean, even some of the third, most of the third parties that are interviewed, they all seem to have some sort of agenda, some sort of bias. There's no sense that anyone is open to what the truth may be. Michael, God bless this man, he comes across as a total dramatic liar who constantly makes himself the victim at every turn. And I can't stress dramatic enough. I mean, you just have to watch it to see what this guy does. Again, Natalia's not interviewed for this documentary, but they show clips of her being interviewed by social workers and forensic investigators and things like that, plus the videos that Michael shoots. Christine would shoot videos of Natalia whenever she was confronting her about something. She never comes across as this poor, defenseless child. She always seems to be lying about something. And again, that's just how it struck me. She just, you know, reeks of dishonesty. She's never consistent in her stories, and she's willing to change her stories at the drop of a hat in an effort to make her stories be consistent or to make sense in some way. We are totally left with the impression that Christine is a monster. I won't go into all the things that's said about her because, again, I don't know how much we can trust Michael, but some of the stories that are told are just horrific about this woman. I hope they're not true, but I'm kind of left believing that a lot of them are. Only the oldest son who agreed to be interviewed seems to be trying to tell the truth. But even he was caught on a hot mic, consulting with his dad after one interview where he, and it's not clear what exactly he's talking about, but he confirms with his dad that they were not going to bring up an incident where she kicked someone down the stairs. The she, I assume, is Christine. The someone is one of the children, but I don't know who. Otherwise, I just feel bad for this kid because, I mean, this is a kid that had all the promise in the world. And in both the 2019 and 2022 video, he's living in his dad's basement with seemingly without a job or without a career. He is totally broken by this experience, as far as I can tell. Like, it really, really was something he has not been able to process. He's just broken. And you know, it's, you walk away from all this mess and he's the only one you're, where you want to pray that he gets some help that he needs. It's sad. Okay, so this is supposed to be the conclusion, but this is going to be more me rambling about what went on in this case. And I have so, so much I want to say, but I'm trying not to just word vomit here. First, I think Natalia's just this enigma. She looks like a child, and so many of the pictures and videos were shown. She writes like a child. Her handwriting looks like something you'd see from a kindergartner. She colors like a kindergartner would. You know, she can't stay in the lines, all that stuff. But when she dresses like an adult, she looks like an adult. When you see that picture of her next to the other six-year-old with that rare form of dwarfism, it's just obvious these two children are not the same age. There's a part where a surgeon who worked on Natalia's spine was being interviewed in the criminal case, and he stated that Natalia's growth plates were still open when he operated on her, which would mean she was still a child. She was still growing. There's this dentist who allegedly said she has all her adult teeth, but we never hear from the dentist. We only hear this from Michael. Then we've got her mom saying, no, she was born in 2003. Then you've got the nurses from the hospital saying, that girl was an adult. She acted like an adult. She confessed to being an adult. I mean, if you put a gun to my head and said, was Natalia a minor or not? I would, with great hesitation, and only because you've got a gun to my head, take the side that she appears to be a child. I think she was a sick child, a mentally ill child, but a child nonetheless. I don't think she was 6 years old when she was adopted, but I don't think she was 22 either. And again, I'm discounting everything Michael says because none of it is consistent. None of it appears to be reliable to me. So, you know, like I mentioned, him saying the dentist said she only had adult teeth, don't believe it. You know, him saying that the bone density survey said she was 14, at a minimum 14 when she was adopted, don't believe it. Didn't see any of those records. You know, but I do have this surgeon saying her growth plates are open. We have her mother confirming the birth date. You know, these pieces of evidence mean something to me. But I also, there's no reason for those nurses at that hospital to lie. And they firmly, firmly believe she was an adult to the extent that she was placed in the adult wing of the facility. So I have no confidence in my decision. And if you told me I was wrong, I wouldn't bat an eye, because I very easily could be. So if she is a kid, why is she telling her neighbors at the apartment that she's an adult? I think she was coached to say that, because if she is a kid and she's being told, look, we're going to give you your own apartment, we're going to buy you groceries, we're going to pay for your bills. How cool is that? I mean, as a child, you don't fully appreciate the situation. You just hear, I get my own place. I don't have parents. I can watch TV all night if I want to. I can eat ice cream for dinner every night if I want to. I could see where that would be very attractive. But if people thought she was a child and the police came and investigated, you would expect that the first thing they do, if they believe she's a child, is to take her into custody, put her in the foster care system. You know, this is obviously a child who's dependent, is the legal term, and needs supervision from an adult. You know, I think she was disliked by her neighbors at the end because she became a pest, because she had nothing going on in her life. You know, all she could do is watch TV and play on her phone. How long is that going to keep you entertained, really? So she's looking for some way to socialize. She's never really been given a chance to develop any social skills, so she doesn't know the appropriate way to do it. Neighbors also commented, like, she didn't understand basic hygiene. She would never wash her clothes, and that, of course, can be attributed to her being physically unable to use the washing machine. But even simple things like combing her hair or bathing, she wouldn't do. And some of them speculated that she lacked the physical ability to change clothes. I find that a little suspect. It seems a little extreme. But let's take a step back from the age question, okay? Let's talk about how the Barnetts should have handled this. Now, again, this takes place in Indiana. I don't know Indiana law. I can only speak to how you would handle it in Alabama. I am going to assume, though, you know, as we move forward and forward in time throughout American history, you see that a lot of laws throughout the country, amongst the states, start matching each other. So there's some level of consistency. So Indiana's not going to have the same laws as Alabama, but they're going to have something close to it in most situations. So in Alabama, what you would do, if you have this uncontrollable child who's pulling knives on you and trying to poison your coffee and has a history of mental illness, and you've got psychiatrists who are willing to say she's a danger to the family, you would petition the juvenile court. You would file what's called a CHINS petition, which is an acronym for a child in need of supervision. And basically what this is saying to the court is, formally, we admit defeat. We cannot take care of this child. She is out of control. She doesn't listen to us. She's a danger to both us as parents and to our children. We need the state to take over here. Now, these petitions aren't routinely granted because the state doesn't want to take on that responsibility. So you need to have some good evidence. And the whole idea this even exists is because there's so many laws that hold an adult responsible for a child's actions. You know, the most classic example would be truancy laws. You know, you can drop your kid off at school, but if they refuse, you know, if they hide on you, refuse to go to class, what can you really do? But, you know, if they're missing too many classes, eventually you as a parent is going to get called to face criminal truancy charges. And so this is just a way to say, we're trying. We need out from under these obligations. Now, the Barnetts, based on their story, probably could have succeeded on a Chin's petition. But I don't know if they actually truly, really had enough documentation like they claim they had to make this happen. I mean, during the course of me telling the story in its haphazard form, how many times did they call the police? Once? They took Natalia to, you know, doctors multiple times, they claim. But I'm not willing to believe what Michael says. All I know is that she was committed after the incident at the farm. There may very well have been multiple trips to psychiatrists and psychologists. And if true, those records would have been very helpful, because they would have shown that this was a family trying to do everything they could to help this child, and it just wasn't working. But would, and you know, one question I have to ask is, would the Barnetts even want to ask the courts for this relief? Okay, Christine ran a daycare for autistic children. Michael helped run this kind of sports rec league for children with special needs. They were being looked up to in the community, and they really liked that. So would it be an admission of failure on their part to go to the court and say, you got to help us out here? Could, you know, would their personality allow them to admit failure in such a public way? Okay, so let's look at another option. Instead of doing what I would consider the smarter move, they go to court and they re-age Natalia, right? Which I do have to say, you know, re-aging isn't common, but it's not unheard of, especially when you're dealing with foreign adoptions. And they get into this in the documentary. A lot of times a child's age will be lowered to make them look more attractive to potential adoptive families. But obviously, in most cases, you're not going to present a 15-year-old as 5. It's the difference of a couple years. So how does a trial court go about making this determination? Well, honestly, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, in reality, what happens is the trial court is going to hold a hearing where they accept evidence, and based upon that evidence, decide whether or not there's good cause to change a child's birth certificate. It's hard to say what happened in this particular case because all of the filings and testimony were placed under seal. I suspect that's because they were dealing with a potential juvenile. And typically, anytime you're dealing with an adoption matter, most states will just, as a knee-jerk, place that information under seal. Especially here, this was a closed adoption. And so that means nobody wanted to divulge any of Natalia's past in an open forum. So, you know, on the record. Now, apparently what happened here is the judge was convinced by the evidence that Natalia had not grown in at least 4 years. And then the judge on his own decided that most people stop growing at the age of 18. You add on 4 years to that, that makes her 22. So we changed the date of birth from 2003 back to 1989 to reflect her true age, in the judge's opinion. Certainly, there is no degree of accuracy with this. It's based purely off of the evidence that's provided. And there's accusations made that the court in this case didn't even hold a proper hearing. It merely took the evidentiary submissions made by the Barnetts, relied on it, and decided that Natalia was underaged, that she needed to have her birth certificate adjusted. In the documentary, they actually interview the attorney who represented the Barnetts in this matter. And she says, you know, based on what was presented to me and what we filed in court, I felt like there was good cause to change Natalia's date of birth, but ultimately the judge determined how much. So, you know, and frankly, the judge could have found that she was 18, 25, 45, 95. There's really no rhyme or reason to it. It's one of those situations where the law is called in to make a decision, arguably that it's not qualified to do so, but it needs to be done because it's involving legal documents. And we get a situation like this where a judge kind of decides that you stop growing at 18 and use that to create this kind of mini formula. What really, really confuses me about this entire saga is the criminal aspect of it. Because once that order comes out re-aging Natalia, legally, she is now born in 1989. Whether or not biologically that's correct, that's where we stand legally. And so for the police and the prosecutors to spend so much time investigating whether the Barnetts had committed child abandonment is bizarre, because as a matter of law, they couldn't have. It was a legal impossibility to make that finding. Now, what the documentary tells us, and I'm going to take it face value, is that under Indiana law, when you adopt a child, you are responsible for taking care of that child financially and otherwise, until the child reaches the age of 21. Well, here, this re-aging made Natalia 22. So essentially, the Barnetts had no legal obligation to support Natalia in any capacity once she's re-aged. And, you know, this strikes me as the police and the prosecutors just didn't agree with this civil order and decided they wanted to criminally punish the Barnetts. And, you know, this, just as an attorney, this is a little offensive to me, because again, there is no possibility of you being able to prove this, because you have a legal fact that you cannot overcome. The judge, in my opinion, in the criminal case, did not err in saying her age has been established. We're not going to spend this entire trial arguing that before the jury, because the jury cannot make a finding that's contrary to this legal fact. Yet, the prosecutors and the detectives wanted to do this, and you know, it makes you want to say, don't you have anything better to work on? Are there not missing children in your jurisdiction? Are there not murderers that need to be investigated and prosecuted? And, you know, I say this with no love in my heart for Michael or Christine, but this is akin to charging a man with statutory rape because he had sex with a woman that, in your opinion, looks too young to be having sex. Well, that's not how the law works. You know, we draw lines. We say this is the age of consent, and it varies from state to state. But you don't prosecute because you think she looks too young. You only prosecute when she is too young to give consent. I mean, to do otherwise would be absurd, and you would have no clue what the law is, and you would be at the whim of a prosecutor, maybe one who's just got out of law school, to make the determination of whether or not the person you had relations with looked old enough. Now, the state had options here. And again, I have to stress, I don't know Indiana law. And so I don't know what mechanisms are available to challenge the determination of Natalia's age. But I feel confident in saying that there are going to be mechanisms in place to attack a judgment that is procured by deceit or fraud or any other, you know, inequitable method of reaching the result a party wanted. You know, if they've got all this evidence that Natalia is a child, you can't just go rushing into criminal court and charge somebody with this so long as you've got that order saying she is an adult. You have to undo that order first. And so the state would need to be able to go back into the civil court, the probate court, and say, we know you've entered this order. We believe it was entered, or we believe the evidence that was presented to you, Judge, was presented in a deceitful way, in a fraudulent way. And because she is now, the tricky part here is standing, the legal concept of standing. Okay. You know, if Bob and Sue are getting a divorce, I can't intervene in that divorce just because I want to. That is between Bob and Sue. They're the only parties that have standing to how their divorce is going to play out. If Bob and Sue get into a car accident with each other, again, the lawsuit only affects Bob and Sue. So they are the only ones with standing. I can't come in and say, well, I think Bob was driving crazy and watching it hurt me. That's ridiculous. So the problem the state would have in undoing this birth certificate amendment is the issue of standing. How could they challenge, you know, what interest do they have in challenging a child's amended birth certificate? Well, one way they could do this is to say the state of Indiana is providing her with food stamps and other benefits. And we would not have to do that if she were a child, because the Barnetts would be responsible for that. So I do believe they could create standing to come in and say, we believe at a minimum this birth certificate was changed fraudulently for the reasons of helping to have this child be able to obtain food stamps and other social benefits she would not otherwise be entitled to. See, there's so many variables you have to deal with in the law. It's just a mess. And, you know, that's what you see here in this whole case is it's a mess. You know, you just, or I walk away from this thinking the Barnetts are just up to no good in all of this. I don't know what their problem was. You know, I don't know what their motive for disliking Natalia was. I believe the son, because he seemed so honest and forthright in his interviews. And so I do believe there was a problem with Natalia acting in a way that made life living in that house somewhere between uncomfortable to dangerous. And I don't have any trust in Natalia. She seems like a scammer, a con artist. You know, on the Dr. Phil show, I believe she was a scam artist at whatever age she was. The police and prosecutors, I'm very disappointed in, frankly. They went wildly off course because they tried to prosecute a criminal charge that they knew or should have known they legally had no chance of winning. It was impossible for Michael to be found not guilty. And that's one of the first rules I always try to teach young lawyers, because it was one of the first rules I learned and I saw play out in a case, is never just assume that the state has the right to do what they're doing. Always challenge their authority for their actions. At least look into it. And here, certainly I was not, that, you know, the documentary does not give us an inside look into the legal strategizing and planning and tactics of Michael's counsel or Christine's counsel, even though it does touch on what they're doing to some degree. But that to me is, that's the first issue, is the state, as a matter of law, cannot prove these charges. And maybe that's what Michael's attorneys did. And maybe that's why the judge gave a jury instruction that made the jury feel like they couldn't bring back a guilty verdict. Now, to me, I don't know why the judge wouldn't just dismiss the charges in that case, but so many of our judges are elected and they're scared to do anything that makes it look like they're being soft on crime. So, you know, ultimately the entire criminal case boiled down to, could the state do this? And the answer was no. You know, that the jury was not on Michael's side at all, as I mentioned before. They just had no choice but to bring back a not guilty verdict. And with that, I think I'm done wrestling with this octopus of a case. I know it's kind of a bumpy ride, and I apologize for that, but, you know, this whole case was a whole lot of flash with no substance when you get right down to it. It's very intriguing. It's very compelling. It's, you know, you've got this girl that's afflicted with dwarfism, and we can't tell whether she's 8 or 22. I mean, that's wild. Before you ask, because I had to look this up, this was not the inspiration for the movie The Orphan. There was actually another case in Norway, and I don't dare to try to pronounce the people's names involved with that one. But that was the case that inspired The Orphan. This is just another one, which is scary in and of itself, that even after we have a case that gets worldwide attention of somebody pretending to be an aged or not, we have another case that arises shortly thereafter. And it's unfortunate to the whole adoption industry and community, because kids in that position need all the help they can get. And we read stories like this that kind of make you scared to go out on a limb and adopt a child. It's just not right. So, all right, I said I was done. I'm really going to be done. Let's get to our palate cleanser. And we've kind of tied the palate cleanser in with this week's episode. The case takes place in Indiana, right? So our palate cleanser is about Indiana Jones, you know, the great fictional character. That's pretty good. You know, that's pretty close, right? I'm going to assume you said yes. All right. What is Indiana Jones' least favorite band? What band does he dislike the most? Know the answer. If you haven't thought of it, it's the Rolling Stones. Yeah. Incorporating some sound effects. Aren't we fancy? All right, that's it. I hope you kids enjoyed this episode. Watch the documentary. It's on Investigation Discovery. If you've got the Discovery Plus app, you can find it there. Easy peasy. But know that when you watch it, everything comes across as slimy. All right. And understand, there are some mega bombshells in the documentary that I left out because they don't help the story, but they are scandalous and they make it much more entertaining, frankly. So I'll leave that for you to decide whether or not you want to get into some of the wackiness. As always, you know, like I ask every week, please help us promote the show. We're independent. We don't have corporate backers. Nobody's out there buying listens for us or making sure that we get on the Apple's charts or any of that nonsense. We need y'all to help spread our word so we can keep growing. The more we grow, the more things we can do. You know, it's we have that simple ABG rule. Always be growing. You know, like Glengarry Glen Ross, you know, they had always be closing, we're always be growing. You know, with that, remember that coffee is for growers. Ah, all right. Reviews are nice too. If you want to leave us a review, particularly on Apple Podcasts, because they're the big dogs of the block. And so reviews left there go a lot further than anyone else. Most of y'all have already done so, but if this is one of your first few times listening to this and you've survived this long into the show, I assume that means you dig it a little bit. 5-star review helps us out. If you want even more Killing, Missing, Hidden content, we've got KMH Plus that kind of goes way off the rails into very unusual topics. You get about 2 episodes a month. You may get 3 in June if I can make the Tetris pieces fall into place. And it only costs $5 a month. Again, thank you to Southern Rebel for this case suggestion. See, I do occasionally grant y'all's wishes when you bring me a good wish. But I also, you know, hold her responsible for making me have to go through this because this may be the most hours I've put into a single episode. Because it was such a cluster. All right. With that, I'm leaving you people, at least for a week. I still love you all. I just need to go rest. I've had a cold all weekend. I'm tired. This was hard. But since I was late last week, I didn't want to be late again, you know. So I'm out the door, you dinosaurs. Brad out.
You survived another episode of Killing, Missing, Hidden, the podcast about bad things. Join us next time for another true and thrilling story.